Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, a Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by awesome Patreon backers like the jovial Jim Anderson, the bold Bob Queck, and the sensational Sam G. Today we have myself, Ange, along with Josh and Phil, and we're going to discuss how to GM for turtles. No, not those charming reptiles whose house is on their back, but the players that end up not wanting to engage with whatever challenge is in front of them. Before we dive into that main topic, though, we're going to ask our get-to-know-a-gnome question. What was one time you or a player at your table rushed headlong into something and made the game way more interesting? Josh, I'm going to start with you.
I love playing impulsive dumpster fires. I was in a friend's homebrew campaign, and I was playing an alchemist, like a demolition expert. And his entire species suffered from like this ancient curse. And on a mission, we were supposed to steal and then destroy this alchemical liquid that had these mind-controlling properties. But when we got the liquid, I figured out that it had something to do with my character species' curse. And there was one player in the group who was very much like, no, this is very evil. We have to destroy it. You have to promise me that you're going to destroy it. And I totally crossed my fingers behind my back and raised my hand and said, yes, I'm absolutely going to destroy this. And I didn't. And that caused so much drama and so much fallout later in the campaign when it was revealed that I had given it to an NPC to like study. And they were studying it, but the person that they were using to study it I had like gotten loose and was rampaging through the city, and yeah, it was delicious.
Consequences. What about you, Phil?
So I was playing a Dungeon World game with that Sneezak was running, and one of the players summoned a elemental. So they were supposed to be able to just summon elementals, but they had asked if they could summon like elementals, but could they be like dead gods? And Chris was like, yeah, that's a great idea. That's like, what could go wrong? And so this character summoned this creature. We were going to fight these wyverns across this chasm that was just the only thing connecting both sides was this large, like super large linked chain, like, you know, chain link chain running across. And so the druid goes to summon the elemental, in this case, the lightning hand, and fails the roll. So Chris is like, yeah, you can summon it, but it's out of control. Like, if you try to cast it, it's going to damage you. And so I was like, I will absorb the lightning hand, run up the chain, and attack the wyverns. And Chris is like, okay, but it will also hurt you if you, you know, attempt to discharge it. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm fine. I'll just, you know, I'm going to do what I can. So he's like, cool, make it defy danger. I roll a 6-. Totally botched the roll. Chris is like, okay, roll 2d12 damage, which for Dungeon World is an obscene amount of damage. So I'm like, to me, right? Not to the wyverns. I might have been to everybody, but including me. And so I rolled, and I wound up rolling, I think, a 4 on 2d12. And so I blew the wyverns away, and I'm standing there charred, but like, believing at that point that my character was invincible, that like no damage or danger could harm this barbarian. So, but it was a very impulsive moment to just scoop up rather than let the druid try to bumble the lightning hand any longer. So it was fun. How about you, Ange?
So I was going to talk about John Arcadian was running a Storm King's Thunder game several years ago, early time of the pandemic. And there was a point where our characters were overlooking a valley, and we could see that the giants and orcs were doing something down in the valley, very nefarious. And they're debating, like, do we get involved with this now? My character just fireballed down into the valley, because I'm like, this is a now problem. We're not letting this go. But I got thinking, and while I was at Origins, I was reminded of a Serenity game where I was playing River Tam, and I apparently completely sidestepped the plot the GM had intended for the game, and everything became what happened when River wandered off. Like, the GM was saying at Origins that he may run that game at Next Origins because the plot has never actually been presented to the players. He's like, yeah, you took off wandering as River does, and the entire game changed course. And as a result, he's like, you guys had a great time. It was a fantastic game, but it had nothing to do with the scenario I planned. So he may actually bring that up next year at Origins.
That's awesome. Fun.
So moving on into our main topic of discussion, at the end of June, Phil put out an article discussing the foibles of planning in RPGs. It's a fantastic article, so if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. But it also got me thinking about an adjacent topic that I like to call turtling. This is when the players do everything they can to avoid putting their characters in danger and thereby ignoring the meat of the game. There's a variety of reasons why players do this, but the real thing we need to discuss is what GMs do about it and what do we do when we have players not engaging with the game we've brought to the table. So, moving right on into our first question, why do players do this? What could cause a player to turtle up and not do stuff in the game? Phil, I'll toss this one to you first.
Oh, I feel like you should toss it to Josh because Josh has got a great answer looking at the notes, and it would just be the same one I was going to use. So Josh, I'm going to just immediately deflect to you because you have the what I think is the number one answer.
My first thought was I love this topic, and the second thought was it's a lack of trust. This is why people turtle up. And it's either like they don't trust themselves, like they don't trust their mastery of the rules in order to play at the level that, you know, maybe other people are playing at the table, or they don't trust their ability to RP, and they're like, no, I don't want the spotlight, because I'm not going to do it right. They don't trust themselves. Or, and I think this is probably more times than not, it's that they don't trust the GM.
Right.
Maybe it's because they've been burned in the past by a bad GM. Maybe it's because they don't know this one yet. Maybe it's because, you know, you as a GM have done some stuff that have caused them to like pull back and not want to engage with the kind of stories you tell. But I think it all comes down to that lack of trust.
I have some players who have been playing since the 80s, and sometimes I just want to say, show me on the doll where the GM in the 80s hurt you.
On the GM screen. Show me on the GM screen. Yes. For sure.
I think there's also an aspect of sometimes the players can think too realistically about the situation, and they think about what would I do if I were in this situation, and they basically kind of sidestep the tropes of whatever the genre is you're playing, because like that's not the trope of most games. The trope is you engage with the adventure. But if they're thinking too much like themselves, they're like, well, I would never do that. And, you
know, I would never go into the basement when there's a serial killer on the loose, or, you know, right. Why don't you just throw a chair out the window and run away?
I think a good way to sum up a lot of what you guys are talking about is really expectations management. Right? Like having a full understanding of like, hey, this is the type of game we're playing, and this is the expectation of like how reasonable danger is. I actually just ran into this with my players, and I mentioned it in the article that you talked about planning, but it relates to this as well. My players were playing Mutants in the Now, right? The kind of inspired by the TMNT game. And so these mutant animals are about to go breaking into the top floors of this hotel in Chicago where the Yakuza are trafficking mutant animals for nefarious purposes. And the players are like, wow, there's only like six of us. And that like there's like three floors of Yakuza. and I'm like, okay, guys, like GM to players, like remember, this game has what are called unnamed NPCs, which are like cannon fodder. NPCs. So I'm like, don't sweat that there's like a ton of Yakuza because they're made to plow through. Like I just had to remind them, like, it's okay. Like you guys are still the stars of the show. Like there'll be some named NPCs for you to fight, but expect that there's going to be like hordes of these guys for you just to kind of run through and just be awesome about it. And so kind of resetting that expectation with them, they were like, Yeah, yeah, all right. And so their plan basically was, we're going to rappel to the top of the building and just fight our way down. And I was like, perfect. That's a great plan. Like, for this game, that's a perfect plan. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I ran into this with an Uncharted Worlds campaign I ran a few years ago. Again, it was this collection of players that a lot of them were older players and tend to be very, you know, like, well, the GM's going to screw me over on this. It's like, that's not, I'm a cream puff, guys. That's not how I play. But it had been, you know, turtling after turtling after turtling, and I kept trying to get them to engage with the game. And the final straw and kind of the last adventure I ran for that campaign was I sent them to an abandoned mine station. Well, I'm sorry, it wasn't an abandoned mine station. A mine station that had fallen out of contact. And they were sent to investigate why are they out of contact. And they arrive and they very quickly discover that pirates have taken all of the residents hostage and taken over the station. Now, the main pirate captain and his crew are off doing something else, but he left some guards behind. So first session, they figure out what's going on. They deal with those guards and, you know, that's the end of the session. Next session, it's supposed to be the pirate captain is coming back. What do you do? And one of my players was like, well, we did what we were supposed to. We found out what was going on. We should leave now. And I had it at that point, and I just looked at my players and I'm like, that's fine. If you want to leave, you can. But that's the end of the session today. Because I'm running a game for big damn heroes, not people who run away from danger and leave innocent people to die because they won't do the thing.
Yeah, and I think that's that expectation management, right? It's like that you're to have that discussion and say, hey, this game we're playing, right? You guys are going to be big damn heroes. So you need to do, you know, big damn hero things during the course of the game. And on my end, like, I'm going to scale the game with the idea that you are big damn heroes and can do big damn hero things. Like, I'm not going to just quash you because, you know, you decided to make a stand, you know, that kind of thing.
Josh, have you ever experienced this in your games?
Yeah. So a lot of times it's when we're switching genres, right? Like if we've switched from like a rules heavy game, a lot of system mastery, to something that's more rules light, more narrative focused, there'll be like a cognitive load that we have to undertake to like physically get into the mindset of, all right, it's less like worrying about how the dice are going to go and more worrying about like the cool stuff we can come up with. And so sometimes that causes, like, at least in my groups, it causes us to be a little bit more reserved until we get the flow of things. And so I can totally see how for like someone who is like just joining a group maybe, or someone who's been away from the hobby for a while or what have you, like any reason for them to be reintegrating, to be a little bit more hesitant, especially if they haven't like gotten a handle on like how the game flows and what's going to happen. Cause I mean, I've guilty of this as a GM of being like, all right, let's try this. Let's go into a completely different genre. Let's try something fresh. Let's try something new. And then running it exactly the same way that I was running the last thing. Yeah.
I think there's also with new players and players who have been away from the hobby for a long time, we GMs tend to forget that a lot is happening in their brains, in their imaginations. It's not necessarily making it to the table.
Absolutely.
So I tend to try and be a little more forgiving with new players. I'll regularly like go to them and be like, what are you doing? And draw them into things. But I tend to expect that they are more in observation mode with their imagination inside their head doing all the heavy lifting.
And times like those, I'll definitely try to check in with the player. Like if I clock that someone in the group is being more quiet, more reserved, I'll try to make a point of checking in with them regularly. And like, because sometimes people just like hanging out and vibing with a whole bunch of people and listening to everybody else do cool stuff. And they don't want to worry about having to come up with the cool stuff that their character is going to do. And they're fine with that. If that's how they're enjoying the game, cool.
They are. But I find those types of players take a lot out of me as a GM. If I have a player that I know is a regular player and not a complete newbie, and I have to constantly like pull at them to get them to engage with anything, it's exhausting. You know, so I try and have that Like, people are going to play in their own ways, but if you're not giving me anything, that means I have to give more to you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
We've touched on this a little bit, but how do you handle this behavior when it happens at your table? Phil, I'll toss it back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the simplest thing is to just kind of bring it up, right? Just ask, like, hey, what's going on? Like, why don't you guys want to take action? Because sometimes it can be just a misunderstanding, right? Like, they might have heard something, like when you were giving out clues or whatever the intel was for what they're setting up for. And you said one thing about the guards, but they, like, completely misinterpreted that, like, oh, there's, like, you know, these guards are impossible to destroy or whatever, so of course we can't attack it or whatever. Like, sometimes it's just a mismatch like that. But I really think the best thing to do is just, when you see it, pause the game and just have the discussion about it right there and just ask the question, like, hey, what's happening? Like, do you not have enough information to move forward? Do you think that you're completely outclassed and that you don't want to move forward because, you know, you think this is going to be like some sort of asymmetrical fight where you're just going to get slaughtered? Usually, like, it's along those lines where there's a disconnect between, like, what you have behind the screen. You're like, this is a perfectly reasonable, balanced encounter. But what the players have heard is, like, this will be an uphill slaughter in which many of you, most of you, won't make it, right? And so somewhere in that disconnect, you kind of have to close the gap back on it and be like, okay, what are we missing? Like, do you need to do some more intel to kind of calm your nerves? Did you misunderstand something? Can I clear something up for you? So I usually just very politely bring it up at the table and be like, this is what I'm seeing. Tell me what's happening on your side.
This is one of those places where I will tend to speak to the competency of the characters. Mm-hmm. And if I know a player is playing a character that should be confident in facing this particular situation, I'll kind of call it out to them. Like, this is no worse than anything else you've faced before. You know, you know how to deal with this stuff. This is something your character is comfortable approaching. I'll do the same thing with other, you know, like when I give clues or there's skill challenges, you know, I'll just, point out, your character is competent in this. And not all GMs do that. And I find that it frustrates me as a player when a GM doesn't do it and just relies purely on the player's knowledge rather than acknowledging that the character probably knows more about the world than the player does.
Mm-hmm. Giving some sort of idea of the scale or the scope of the challenge in front of them, right, is really helpful. And it works in the other direction too. Like, this is something completely outside of what your characters have ever experienced. Well, that kind of clues them into that it is that uphill battle where most of them might not survive. But if that's not the case, it's really important to know, like, what level they're looking at.
So what are some things you need to be careful of when trying to get your players into the thick of the game and they're turtling up? Josh, I'll start with you.
So depending on the way they're turtling, my answer changes, right? If they're being actively, like, misanthropic and being like, no, like, this is, I'm gonna go in the completely opposite direction that you're pointing and open an inn and, you know, retire, right? Then that's a conversation to obviously have. And maybe, you know, the place where you need to be careful is not having that conversation in front of the whole group. Maybe it's call for a break and take them aside and be like, hey, I'm getting a weird vibe. Like, are you okay? Is everything all right? Are you having a bad day? But if they're, like, more just, like, quiet and, like, not wanting to make decisions and being very internal with the character and how they're experiencing the game, then singling them out could cause them to, like, retreat more. So in those cases, I try to be a little more subtle with pulling them back in. Like, maybe I'll wait until the rest of the party is doing all of that big onerous planning that can go around and around for, you know, 15, 20, an hour at a time. I'll use that to my advantage. And I'll be like, okay, so you, let's have a little side RP. Like, what's going on in your brain? Like, what's your character thinking right now? How are you seeing this sort of thing? And, like, try to, like, subtly pull them back in that way.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a difference in my mind between the player that turtles and the player that, like, I call them the reluctant adventurers, where, like, they've made a character that doesn't want to go on the adventure. It's, you know, it's your Peter Parker didn't want to be Spider-Man to start with. Bilbo didn't want to go on the adventure with the dwarves to start with. And I think the things players like that sometimes forget is that eventually those characters still heeded the call to adventure.
Yeah, they're reluctant heroes, not... Yes. Like, not run away from hero. Like,
not absentee
heroes.
Right,
but they get so caught up in that initial reluctant hero that they never actually start the adventure. And it's like, no, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. I do think you need to also be careful of not railroading the players, because you don't want to take away their agency. If they are turtling, but you still need to get things moving, it can be very hard to figure out the right balance of pushing them to the next thing while also, you know, avoiding like just shoving them on the train tracks and, you know, hit and go.
Because it breaks that trust, like I was talking about earlier, and just reinforces like reasons why they were doing it in the first place.
Do you have any thoughts on what to be careful about here, Phil?
Yeah, I think you touched on the most important ones, right? Which is don't force them into it. Don't take away agency. I think the other one you have to be careful with is if they're not feeling very secure, bringing the fight to them, you know, the old kick in the door with ninjas kind of thing, mm-hmm. might not work as well as you think it will. If they're having some sort of disconnect about their competency or the scale of difficulty or whatever, you know, also bringing the fight to them may panic them. And you've right. basically put their backs to the wall. I think the worst thing you could do is solve this problem in game. I think whatever this is, it's a player GM discussion, not a character. It's not a thing you fix at the character level, like by like, hey, we're just going to push story through this until we get it, you know, until we get it on, you know, back on track. It's way better to just jump back up to the player GM level and be like, we're going to solve this or have this discussion together right here. And then when everything's cool, we'll get back into the story and get this flowing again.
I think it's very much dependent upon the nature of the turtling, because there's sometimes, like, you know, Josh said, you have a player that just wants to kind of sit there and absorb things as they're going. And that's different from the players who actively avoid engaging with the story. Like, they are role-playing, they're playing their character, but they're doing it in such a way that they're kind of blocking everything from proceeding forward.
And that could be somebody who doesn't, you know, understand the game. Like, that's like if you're playing it cautious and paranoia, or you're trying to keep your fiasco character out of trouble, you've like missed the game, right? Like, you're actually just playing a different game than everyone else is. And that's another one of those things where you have to be like, hey, we should go back over. Like, this is fiasco. Like, the goal in this game is to see how bad you can do. Like,
it's fiasco. It's going to end with something on fire, and usually somebody is naked.
Yeah, and hopefully just both are the same thing. Like, that's...
Have you ever had this happen when you're a player at the table? And how did you did you help the situation, or did you make it worse?
I can't think of any specific examples because I play so much less than I GM. But yeah, I try really hard when I, like, if I'm sitting down at a con game or something. It doesn't matter how you present me the hook, I'm taking it. Like, I think it's just the best thing you could do. I know I shouldn't trust this person. Like, I know this person seems sketchy that's giving me this quest or whatever, but we're in a con game. I'm taking it. Like, 100, like, I'm 100% in. Like, we'll sort out what happens later. Like,
I mean, I said at the beginning that I like playing dumpster fires, and this is one of the reasons, right? Like, low wisdom, high impulsivity is like my sweet spot. Mostly, I think, because I am in no way like that in real life. But it's great because, A, yeah, sure, okay, shady guy in a suit in the corner of the bar who's offering our Shadowrun team this job, I am in no way going to question you. I'm just going to sign on the dotted line.
You seem very trustworthy, yeah. Mr. Johnson.
I don't see any reason not to trust him. He's our best friend now. But also, it's a great way to rope in the players that might like try to go in the opposite direction. Because, like, if I'm playing the character that just, like, throws my arm around the person and like, starts to drag them into the shenanigans, you know, like, you're my best friend now, and I'm going to take you along with me for this ride. Oops, watch out for that pit trap, friend. We've talked about ways of, you know, taking it away from the table, not trying to solve it with story. And there's not many ways that a player outside of saying, like, hey, maybe we can, like, calling for a break or, you know, checking in out of character can do. But in game, if you're just trying to rope someone into the action, like, being that forceful extroverted personality to against the introverted Bilbo Baggins at the beginning of The Hobbit, who just wants to stay home and read his books and eat food, being the Gandalf or the dwarves or whatever to push him out the door is, I think, one of the things you can do.
I remember the start of a D&D campaign quite a few years ago where myself and the other very active player were both playing very, very low charisma characters. These are characters that should never be in any kind of negotiation ever. And all of the players who had characters with high charisma were not engaging with the guy offering us the job. And so finally, like, I'm sitting there waiting. And finally, like, how much do you pay? 2,000 gold. Okay, we'll do it. And just, like, taking the job because, like, we got to do this somewhere. We probably could have gotten like 5,000 gold out of the guy if the players with, you know, if the bard or the warlock had actually like tried to negotiate with the guy. But we needed to get things rolling. So sometimes it's the, like I mentioned that situation in John Arcadian's game where I made it a now problem by casting fireball over the heads of all the people negotiating what we were going to do about the situation. Sometimes you just need to make it a now problem and get things rolling.
I mean, didn't you once have a player, Ange, in a Kids on Bikes game or a Tales from the Loop game not want to ride a bike?
Yes. I had a player who insisted that because her character was poor, she didn't have a bike. And I'm like, it's the 80s. Even if you hobbled it together from junkyard parts, you have a bike.
I assure you, was poor in the 80s and I had a bike. Like,
yeah, it's like you find the $10 bike at the garage sale or three parts of a bike at the junkyard and put them together. You have a bike.
Yeah.
Yeah, that player was, that player tends to be very, not combative, but stubborn. They get an idea about what the situation is in their head and refuse to adapt it. So it's like, no, they don't have a blanket when they slept in the clubhouse for the night. No, they don't have a bike because they're too poor to have a bike. And it's just like, will you just roll with it, please? Just roll with it.
Can you borrow somebody else's bike? Like, to just
work
with me here. Bikes, it's a thing for this game.
Yeah, and that brings us to, what advice do you give to players to avoid turtling?
I guess it's easier in a one shot, of course, ride it like you stole it, right? Like,
yeah,
just by all means, make all the bad decisions. I know that's harder in a campaign.
I said that so many times at Origins.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a con game, ride it like you stole
it. Exactly. In a campaign, I know it's harder because you want your character to persist. You want to level up. You want to like get to all those things. So I think as a player, it comes to this, like, if it seems like the adventure doesn't make sense, you should just ask. Like, you should just be like, I think you want us to go into this mountain, but from everything we've heard, this mountain sounds like instant death, right? And then give the GM a chance to be like, oh, no, that's not what it was supposed to, like, why do you believe that, you know, and have that conversation. So I think if you're a player and it feels off, you should ask.
Because I think that if the GM is trying to run you through the deadly dungeon, like Tomb of Horrors or something like that, it should be something that's upfront and everyone has agreed upon that's what you're running, that's what you're playing. So have that conversation with the GM. Josh, do you have any advice for players?
9 times out of 10, failure is way more interesting in a story than success. And success that like has further consequences is also interesting. But, and I know sometimes it just doesn't feel good to have your character fail. But if you give it a try, just like just taste failure a couple times, taste intentional failure, fail on purpose like a couple times, it's sweet and it is addictive. You know what? If you do it intentionally in a game, it's a lot more satisfying to see all of the drama that develops in this fictional story. It's not real life. Those failures aren't actually going to hurt you, hopefully, or have any like ramifications on your actual person. All of the good stories, all of the conflict and all of the drama that comes from somebody failing at something. So don't be afraid of that.
Role-playing games are not books or movies or such and such, but some of those story beats can make a role-playing game feel really good if you can have them naturally happen through the game. And all of the material we all look to for inspiration for the games we play have the characters failing before they get that final success. So it's okay to, like, you know, bang your head against a monster and not beat it the first time, because you're going to get it the second time.
From a GM perspective, the thing you need to do is help close that loop for the player, which is when they fail, like, make it interesting, not punitive.
Yes. Yes.
Because right. Because that will then complete the circle, right? The player, you know, took a chance and failed. And then if you just make that failure interesting to the story and interesting to the player, they'll get it, right? The loop will close and they'll be like, oh, I made an impulsive, rash decision because my character's impulsive and rash, and now something really cool has just happened in the game. It's still a failure. I'm in, right? Like, you can make that addiction happen.
Yeah.
But if you just turn around and you're like 67 hit points of damage, right? Then they're going to be like, well, I'm not doing that again.
Like, I think that brings us to our final bit for this episode, which is advice for GMs. You know, beyond what you just said, Phil, of make failure interesting, what else can GMs do to help their players not turtle?
In James D'Amato's The Ultimate RPG Gameplay Guide, he has this whole chapter on running horror games. And there's a small section on character motivations for staying, right? For staying on the inside the haunted house, or, you know, on the cursed island, or wherever they are. What's their motivation for staying? And he lists like five or six different ones, like money or, you know, fame or different like horror character motivations. But finding those motivations when you're building your characters in session zero for whatever kind of game you're playing, like why would your character put themselves in danger? Why do you seek adventure? You know, getting that core motivation down and then building that into the story hooks to bring them in, I think is a really helpful way of getting people out of their getting people out of their shells and getting them on board with the campaign or the adventure or the one shot, what have you.
Yeah, I know for campaigns, I always go out of my way to set expectations for what I'm expecting the campaign to be and what I expect out of the characters in there. And I will always give them, like, your character can be whatever, but you need to be on board with doing X, Y, and Z, because that's the premise for the campaign. Like the Eberron campaign I started, you need to be willing to participate in this competition to try and get a spot on an expedition to Zendrick. Whatever else you want to play, it's all up to you, but you need to be on board for those two things. And that can usually help a lot with, you know, especially at the beginning of a campaign, with players who don't want to engage with something for whatever reason. Do you have anything else, Phil?
Be really expressive, really descriptive about... Normally when people turtle, it's because they're afraid of danger. So if you do a really good job of being very descriptive of whatever it is, like they're looking at the dungeon, the vault or whatever, and, you know, in your descriptions, if it's going to be tough, use words that make it sound like it's tough. And if it's going to be easy, you know, say things like, yeah, there's a bunch of guards, but most of them aren't paying attention. They're fiddling with their phones. They're having, you know, taking, like, hanging out with each other and having a smoke rather than patrolling. Like, convey the words to the players that sometimes when things are a threat, this is a threat. And when it's not, it's not. Right. And just because sometimes that gives them that ease, or it cuts down on the confusion, that disconnect that sometimes causes them to turtle up.
I think that's all very good advice. I think we're ready to get out of here. This show is funded by Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, so our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out.
Check out Thacko with Advantage. Ange and Jared love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together, they share insights into the games they're running in the campaign journal, and then tackle a variety of topics that affect the game in the DM's workshop. Maybe you'll even pick up an ancient D&D factoid about a previous edition of the game that you'll never use.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with Gnome Stew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Meta. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to today? Josh, go.
I want to shout out a backer kit campaign that's running right now. Sandra Taylor's Structuring Life to Support Creativity. And the running joke is, like, the biggest boss in D&D is scheduling conflicts, right? And I,
you're not wrong.
I don't think this book will solve that problem, but Sandra is an incredibly thoughtful and caring individual. They're an amazing project manager and small business owner and a fantastic artist. I've taken one of her workshops, and the way that she talks about structuring your life to make room for the things that you want to be able to create, including campaigns and adventures and building your own, you know, RPGs or what have you. She puts all of that into this book, and it's already funded. So no matter when this podcast comes out or when you listen to it, if you go find it on BackerKit, you should either be able to pre-order it or just buy it outright.
Excellent. Phil, do you have anything you want to give a shout out to?
I do, although I actually just looked up that link, so I'm just checking that out. I just want to give a shout out to Meg Baker, who has been going through cancer treatment. So just wanted to, you know, just send well wishes and love.
I just wanted to point out that Wizards has opened up pre-orders on their 2024 release of D&D. But if D&D isn't your jam, Kobold Press has shipped their copies of Tales from the Valiant, and Daggerheart is still being developed and improved over time. So there are definitely fantasy-based alternatives out there.
Hell yeah.
So, do y'all think this was good enough to keep you out of the turtle soup?
I hope so.
I'm staying in my shell for this one.